menato batagot sa gumba mo yeye sa gara. Kudundu mo warulre kudara nyate. Menato batagot sa gumba mo yeye sa gara. Kudundu mo warulre kudara nyate. Manetje jamano. Def na la ni sama bop ngir segal sun ma adama pour bi yalla baata jojo ko fe man luma war la won rebok ji jamono ya ni man na to bata gut sa gumba mu yi sagare koy dundu ma waru re ko dare mete.
That's the group Africando with Senegalese vocalist Pascal Dieng out front on Sagu. It's a Wolof word meaning peace, harmony, and solidarity among all. This is from Africando's 2006 album, Ketukuba. Africando was formed in 1990 as a collaboration between West African singers and musicians and New York salseros, a couple of them living, by the way, in Paris at the time. West Africa and Central Africa, especially Benin, Senegal, Mali, and Guinea, have long had long love affairs with Latin music due to the West African rhythms that found their way into early Afro-Cuban dance music, made popular by the Afro-Cuban music icon, bandleader, and composer Arsenio Rodriguez. He laid the foundation for what we know as salsa today. The African salsa bands became even more popular in the 50s in Western Central Africa when Afro-Cuban musicians like Machito and Mario Bauza came to New York and blended Afro-Cuban music with popular African-American music and jazz. And by the way, of course, he was singing in Wolof, just in case you were wondering. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And you know, it's Friday, time to free your mind. And based on the events of the past week alone, I'd say there's a lot to talk about. 888-874-4888 gets us started. Let's see where you want the conversation to go. I'm hoping that you would offer up some kind of analysis or commentary on the issues in the past week or so, much to be discussed there, but we'll know what you have to say. This is your show. You call the shots. I am merely the traffic cop. All right. So, but keep it tight, though. We want to get as many people as possible on the air. We have from California, we have Harvey on the air.
Hello, fantastic Eutrice.
Hello, Harvey. How are you, fantastic Harvey?
Very good. We are quantangled.
Yes, we are quantangled.
And I'd like to speak about something, some events that took place. One event that took place this week, and I have one idea for the environment. And one event that took place this week is, here's the headline, Sea Plankton Discovered Outside Space Station. Samples taken from the surface of the space station are found to have traces of sea plankton and other microorganisms, and nobody knows how they got there. So we know that I believe that this is the calling card of the universe, and that we know that, you know, if all sorts of microorganisms and plankton can survive in the harshness of space, then we know that life is tenacious. In fact, that we have a name for them. We call them extremophiles. This is life that lives like 7 miles down in the earth and feeds off of nitric acid or something like that. We have creatures living at the bottom of the ocean, and now we find out that microorganisms are living in space. So I believe that space is kind of it's a womb. It's a womb for life itself, and the universe is full of life. And even though we're down here at each other's throats every day, I believe that seeing the bigger picture, and here's proof of it, that the universe is teeming with, possibly teeming with life, and that we have to look up from our small view of each other into a bigger picture. And secondly, about the environment. Well, I had an idea, and this is to do with space, too. You know, space stations, when you see them, and they have these solar panels that sort of unfold. Once the space station is there, they unfold. Well, I thought that same principle can be applied here on Earth. We can have these large trailer trucks, and, you know, we have these sites where construction takes place, and they use these generators that produce so much, like, so much pollution. And I feel sorry for people working on work sites. So this way, one of these trailer trucks can roll in and the rooftop rolls back, and these hundreds of solar panels can start like unrolling like they do in on the space station, but it could be all hydraulically done, and so they can track the sun and provide electricity for a lot of construction sites. So this would be on-site solar for construction instead of diesel, which is such a bad way to go. And if this was done on a massive scale, it would really save a lot of pollution from happening, and make sure that the people who work on these sites don't have to breathe all that poisonous air.
Well, thank you. You got us started today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Teresa.
From Dallas, we have Sarah on the air.
Greetings to you, Utrecht.
Thank you, and same to you. What have you to say today?
I am doing okay today, Utrecht. Let me start off by wishing you an enjoyable weekend, as well as to the rest of the PRN audience. Utrecht, I had to take a break from the media on yesterday to kind of decompress to myself, because I was getting bombarded with lots of information, and I had a chance to review your archives on yesterday, and I saw that you did a checkup. So I guess I missed the checkup, but it was a good thing that I went ahead and kind of stayed off the airwaves for a bit yesterday. But what I wanted to speak on, Utrecht, is two things really quickly. One of them has to do with the situation that's still unfolding in Ferguson, and we are seeing the different viewpoints from the media and everyone else, and how this case is being tried in the various media platforms. And one of the things that I always want to come back to mind is that we're always like to be told in this country that, okay, that they are good white people, and white people are always here to help us in our struggles and whatever the case might be. But from what I'm seeing unfolding here in Ferguson, is being put on display for the entire world community to see, is that here we have this one cop who is guilty as charged for discharging his firearm and killing an unarmed suspect, regardless of whatever the incident was. He had the power and the authority as a law enforcement person to know when to use his firearms or not. You have all the equipment on you, on your belt, such as a taser that you could have used at first to take down this person. This person was not a suspect. He was not placed under arrest. It was just whatever altercations that y'all might have went into as a result of this jaywalking incident that escalated into a murder. We have seen how the entire apparatus came out in full military gear, in bringing out all of their bells and whistles, all of their trinkets to show to intimidate the black community. We saw what the governor, the district attorney, everyone has come out fully on board in order to protect this one white cop. And they have put all of this at great taxpayers' expense to amass all of this arsenal just to protect this one white officer. Plus, he's on paid administrative leave, and plus, you know, wherever it is he's hiding out, someone is paying for him to be holed up in that position. So we can say and we can talk all we want about how it is not what it is, but my lying eyes is not deceiving me, because I am seeing and everyone else is seeing that these so-called good white people, when these things are happening, no one is standing up in their community and saying, you know what, enough is enough. We are going through a deficit right now in our economy. We are amassing all this overtime pay, all of these stuff from the state troopers to the National Guard. All of these people are activated and out here, all because we want to protect this one person. If this person would have been arrested and would have been placed into the custody of the jail system, this would not have been the pussy, because that's all the people really want. They want this man to be arrested and charged for murder, which is what he did. Because you being a police officer, you have more control than an average citizen who could get into an altercation and decide they want to shoot it out at each other instead of being peacefully. You being trained as a law enforcement, you should know to de-escalate a situation, but instead you aggravated it.
But here's a couple of things I want to... When you talk about the white people part of it, what is the point you're making?
The point that I'm making you, Eutrice, is that we are always hearing that there are always these good people out here. But I'm talking about from the state of Missouri. I'm not speaking about the rest of the United States. I'm just speaking for within the state of Missouri. These good white people within the state that want to come into Ferguson and want to show their solidarity and march and do all that nonsense that they are doing. How about within your community that you mounted up, because y'all are in the majority, take yourself to the state house, wherever, and said, you know what? This enough is enough. This has been going on for 2 weeks. We are paying all of this expense amount for this one white cop who actually did do the killing, regardless of what incident might...
Well, from their point of view, and I'm not saying that I agree with it, but they have a point of view, and their point of view... By the way, there's been a GoFundMe crowd sourcing fund set up that mm-hmm. has crossed the $200,000 mark in support of the police officer. But we know that there is a racial problem, and none other than the U.S. Supreme Court Justice herself, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, has said this is a huge problem in America. Mm-hmm. This is not news to African-American people or Latinos. This is par for the course. But for when you identify with a member of the empowered group, as a member of the dominant society, don't forget that, you know, African Americans are still called minorities. When you are operating in a world with that kind of demarcation, you either are a member of the majority or a member of the minority. You adopt certain attitudes. One thing we need to understand, though, is that in this particular instance, we're seeing a very interesting turn within the white community. We have involvement by a lot of young white folks who are in there. They are going toe-to-toe. A lot of them got arrested as well. In the Eric Garner case, we have the Occupied Wall Street movement actually stepping up to the plate, saying that they will play a role in raising $75,000 to bail out
Ramsey Orta.
So we see a radicalization taken place within the white community. So what I want to do is say that when we make these discussions, when we are engaging in these discussions, you want to be careful not to say that this applies to all white people. It doesn't.
No, when I said white people, you treat, that's why I said I was speaking to specific to what's going on in Missouri. But now that you bring up with the Ramsey Orton, what with the Occupy people, Eutrice, I have the right to be suspect of anyone who's coming out, because right now with the Orta situation, it's good that the Occupy people want to come on and help with the assist with the bail funding. But
correct.
To me, what I'm looking at with this is that here it is that you have been relegated to irrelevancy status. Now you see a high-profile case that you could come out on and tag your name on by saying, okay, I'm going to provide the bail money. I have a right to question you when you're coming out now, because nobody here, nothing but Occupy for about over a year and a half now, but with this case coming up, you want to tag on to that. So yes, I'm going to accept your offer that you want to help, but I got a right to question you as to why it is you want to come into this situation here now.
I don't disagree with your right to be suspicious. I don't. In fact, everybody has a right to be suspicious. As I said before, if a pattern repeats itself often enough, you could accept it as fact. And I also have said that the African-American community in its continuing struggle should operate on the premise that it has no friends. Mm-hmm. I also have said that African-American community must stand up and finance its own liberation. It's got to do that. It has to take that role. But I'm also saying that we must take note of some interesting signals that are being sent, and they are real.
Not nearly enough whites,
and I've talked about that here a lot, not nearly enough whites are vocally concerned or out there basically clamoring for justice either. I've talked about it, and especially as it pertains to the so-called progressive community and the mm-hmm. liberal community, who say nothing in these times. So these are contradictions that we have to deal with. But at the same time, let's not be 100% condemnatory.
No, I'm not going to be 100% condemnatory.
Give a little credit where you see the change occurring.
That's why I specifically stated to the state of Missouri, because I'm not saying because black people have always been the testing ground where these people have come out and where the system, this oppressive system, have always come out to test their equipment. As you see, the heavy-handed way within which they came out with all of their military gear in order to show a show of force, intimidation, and to let the rest of the community know that this is what you have to expect if you were to mount up a resistance. We have always been the testing ground where these things have happened on. And what I'm saying is that if the people in Missouri, because if they come for us like this, white people have more to lose, because it's more of them, and there are more of them in the poverty level than they are of us. And when they come up for you, they're going to come even more heavy-handed, because they know that a lot of whites have guns and other things that they've been amassing. And when they do come heavy-handed, because what happened at Ruby Ridge and what happened with David Koresh up here in Waco is going to be child's play compared to what it is that they're going to do in the white community. So don't think that this is just a black thing. That it's only us that they're pointing this gun at. They're coming for y'all next.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Good to hear from you today. From New York City, Joel, you're on the air.
Good morning or good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello. Good afternoon to you, Joel. How are you today?
I'm good. You know, I wanted to talk about the Ukraine, because I really think that the Obama administration is leading us towards war with the Russian Federation. But I think I'll do that some other time. And I would like to make a couple of brief comments about the situations in New York and in suburban St. Louis, if I may.
Sure, absolutely.
Well, the first thing I'd like to talk about is the fact that I'm sort of asking a rhetorical question. Why would police violence of any sort be considered the solution to violence? It seems to me that the basic premise that's at work here is one of intrinsic qualities of social dysfunction that seem to legitimate or even justify repressive tactics. And so when the Ferguson Police Department released a videotape allegedly showing Mr. Brown shoplifting some cigars, that feeds right into this premise. And when that happened, my mind immediately flashed to a video that I saw on TV about 5 years ago, in which four of the major Wall Street CEOs who run investment banks that could accurately be described as ongoing criminal enterprises, this, you know, by the number of criminal and civil charges made against the banks, not as, you know, as an empty pejorative, not only would it never occur to any cop in America to empty an entire clip into one of these executives under the premise of intrinsic criminality, the entirety of Western policing seems to me to be dedicated to protecting people like this from criminal prosecution and from retribution by those harmed by the criminal acts that they oversee, including millions of African Americans who lost their property. And the second thing that I wanted to talk about was that the growing militarization of the police seems to me to be part of the political economy of the country. And, you know, what the U.S. economy increasingly makes, so to speak, is weapons, faulty financial products, and prisons. And the distribution of military materiel creates a market for this otherwise redundant weaponry. So it seems to me that, what you get is you get a dysfunction and an analogy across the culture, because when you arm the police so that they can cause harm but can't be harmed themselves because of their protective gear, this finds an analog in the drone murders and in the business practices of large corporations. Military drones are a means of murdering people without direct risk of harm to those doing the murdering. And large corporations use their power to take from the rest of us without risk to themselves. In other words, the predatory lending of a housing boom bust is a good example. So here's the punchline, in my view. Cops must be held accountable, or people have a right to defend themselves from the police. Mike Brown had a more legitimate right to self-defense than Darren Wilson had to murder him. And finally, for those people who are looking for resolution from, you know, the political leadership in the U.S., it seems to me that they're deluding themselves. How can anyone forget the empty promises from President Obama and Attorney General Holder that the Justice Department would step in if the courts failed to render a just verdict in the Zimmerman racist murder of Trayvon Martin? Might Darren Wilson have thought twice before pulling the trigger if George Zimmerman was serving a prison sentence worthy of the murder? But it seems to me that, far more to the point, Obama and Holder are the African-American faces now placed on this system of racial oppression. When Obama calls for calm and reflection in the face of Brown's murder, what does he expect the people will reflect on? That Mike Brown was murdered in cold blood by a racist cop in a racist police department that is part of a racist justice system? That, you know, as tragic as Brown's murder is, he is but one of a never-ending stream of black and brown youth who are systematically harassed, intimidated, incarcerated, murdered. That there has never, ever been resolution coming out of this system is evident. And it seems to me that after 6 years in office, what is evident is that Obama and Holder and the rest of them favor an unjust peace to justify social unrest. So what is happening now in Ferguson has been a long time in coming. The police government strategy will continue to be to demonize those rebellion and to come back far more unjust force once the cameras are out of sight. What the corporate state wants is the appearance of order, no matter how unjust that order is. Everything that the federal and the state government and police will say is to coerce unjust calm. Just ask the survivors of the Attica Rebellion or the Black Panthers who are still in prison 30 or 40 years and counting. Ask them about, you know, defending themselves against police violence, if this remains a question. So solving this social racial divide in Ferguson, Missouri, or in New York, or the rest of the nation, really requires something more deep. It requires the redistribution of political and economic power and resources that the powers that be just spent the last 30 years putting into their own pockets. And without this redistribution, words of reconciliation are empty rhetoric designed to shut people up. Until people have the power to force the police to stop killing them, I'm afraid nothing will be resolved.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your analysis today. Thanks so much, Joel, for your call. From Queens, we have Drew.
Hello, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Drew, how are you today?
I apologize, it's a little bit loud. I'm on the streets of New York City at the moment. The reason why I'm calling is because I went to the town hall meeting on Wednesday where Alton Maddox spoke.
Yes.
And towards the end, there was a young lady named Keisha who told everyone if they wanted to help volunteer by, you know, handing out flyers in Brooklyn or the Bronx or Harlem to help raise money to free Ramsey Orta, you know, the gentleman that is incarcerated, who's one of the main witnesses for the Eric Garner case. I went back to they told me to go through these doors, and I went back there, and no one knew anything about what I was talking about. Everyone seemed very confused. It was complete disorder, and I was really sad. Immediately, I thought, and these are the people that are in charge of trying to raise $5,000 to get this guy out of jail. Now, I didn't call to bash them necessarily, but I'm calling to say that this is kind of a problem in our community, I think, in the African-American community. I am African-American. I feel like we're very disorganized. So rather than what it seems like primitively we would think to do is just criticize and do nothing and complain, I decided I'm going to open up my own PayPal account, and I'm going to go look into organizations and help raise the money myself, because I didn't like what I saw.
Okay, well, you know, a couple of things. You have to understand, I mean, I understand your sense of frustration, but on the other hand, you've got to understand how community groups, many community groups, are really inundated with all kinds of demands for their time and attention, and very few people who are stepping up to the plate to be involved. From all of my years in doing community work, I see the same people all the time.
Right.
It's the same 5-6 people all the time. So this is an organizational issue. Number two is, no matter what it is you saw, and it might have given you a bad impression of an organization out of order, that there was no sense of order, let's take a look at the record in terms of how the organization has expressed itself in the community and what it is doing and what it has done. And I think you would agree that the organization is about the only thing happening there in the community that is placing itself in as a shield, really, between the system and apparatus of government and its oppressive expression in the community. So, I mean, what I'm saying is, I think you're just being a little bit, you know, a little bit what's the word?
Dramatic?
Not dramatic, but you know, I think you're making a mountain out of a molehill, really. Because, you know, in the end, the work is being done. And what you saw, you know, it's to me, it doesn't sound like there was a major problem there. It just sounded like you entered at a time when the organization was involved in doing a whole bunch of things. But the overarching issue still remains that the organization is doing the work. No other organization is doing the work. That's the main thing that you ought to pay attention to. But I also want to congratulate you for taking on the responsibility of doing your bit the way you wish to do your bit. So that's great.
Well, can I ask your opinion on something?
Sure.
If we have time. So my question to you is this. What I saw was, I was like, okay, maybe I should volunteer to help them organize this office. Because
I don't want, to be very honest, I don't want this to be a public discussion about what you find wrong about a particular organization. It's not fair.
No, I wasn't going to specifically say anything. I was going to ask you if you think that's a good idea or not.
What's a good idea or not?
If I should volunteer to help try to organize it, if at all possible, if they need the help.
No, that's your decision. You know, I can't tell you what to do. That's your decision. And it's their decision whether to accept your help.
Right, that's true.
Okay, so I mean, the main thing is that you have a concern about being involved in the community. That's great, and you have a concern about using your ability and your assets to contribute, and that's fantastic. Yeah. And you should continue doing that. Thank you, Drew, for your call today. Let's see, we have Patricia from New York.
Good afternoon, Utrecht, and I hope you are well.
Fine, thank you, and I hope the same for you.
Thank you. It's really interesting to follow up on following this last caller, because I think what he witnessed is the difference between corporate influence and the money that goes into organizing and making certain that specific policies and strategies proceed quite efficiently and without a hitch, which is why media is so effective, which is why corporate interest, when getting out the message, is so effective. Grassroots organizations may not be as efficient as he saw, but at this particular point, the only organization that is an effective buffer to oppose the message that is coming out is the organization that the meeting that he attended the other night. But something else interesting happened in New York on this week. I don't know if you read about an incident involving the removal of the American flag from the over the Brooklyn Bridge a few weeks ago.
Yes.
And it was removed and replaced with a white flag, and there's been a big uproar in New York around this. And evidently, two gentlemen, two artists from Germany, have self-identified themselves as the individuals who removed the flag and replaced it with this white flag. What was interesting is that yesterday the mayor came out and said that if, in fact, these two individuals are confirmed to be the people who took down the flag and replaced it with the white flag, that they should be arrested. And my first impression was, my God, you can call for the arrest of people who move a flag, but you cannot call for the arrest of an individual who puts an unarmed man in a chokehold. So removal of the American flag and replacement with a white flag, that has more weight and value than the life of a man who you cannot call for the appropriate justice for him. And I think, African Americans who voted overwhelmingly for this man have to begin to ask themselves, what is it that they expect that this person is going to do on their behalf? And the evidence so far suggests that he intends to keep the power structure in power. He intends to keep those oppressed oppressed, and it's going to be business as usual.
And he has the protection and the love and the loyalty of leading blacks in New York.
Who met with Cardinal Dolan and the mayor recently to try and make certain that what happened in Ferguson indeed does not happen in New York. And I am appalled that, in fact, what happened in Ferguson did not happen in New York. Because, as we know, there should have been an outcry. If not for Eric Gardner, for your brother, for your son, for your uncle, for your father, who any one of them could have been Eric Gardner.
Absolutely. Thank you, Patricia, for your call today.
Absolutely.
Thanks a lot. Quite a few very strong opinions, and I appreciate them. From Baltimore, we have Green. You're on the air.
Hello, Yatrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I hope you're well.
I'm the same as always. I refuse to complain.
So what's on your mind today?
Well, some time ago, you had a program in which you asked your listeners, what is your political philosophy? And I called in at that time to say that my political philosophy could best be described as pan-African black nationalism. Until now, I haven't found any reason to repeat the description of my political philosophy. However, in subsequent calls to your program, my political outlook has been consistently evident. But at no time have I ever said that I was anything other than an African. Other than that, I refuse to label myself or to be labeled by anyone else, and I've been consistent about that. Now, I learned when I was a child that a person has to be careful not to speak about things of which they are not certain. Otherwise, you run the risk of being either a liar or a hypocrite, and even worse, in the case of black people, you run the risk of misinforming someone, and that's something that we should be careful never do. So let me just say that Pan-Africanism is the idea that all Africans are one. There are no boundaries between us. In that sense, the idea of any African being an immigrant with...
May I say this? Could we move beyond, tell me, rather than tell us about Pan-Africanism as a philosophy, could you give us an idea of how this applies in our day-to-day lives. Personally, that's your philosophy. We don't have on the program, we don't have a record of people calling up and saying, well, I want to preach to you about what communism is, or I want to talk to you about what any particular political ideology is. It's the forum is about engaging in discussion and debate. So if you can move us in that direction, it would be great.
No, well, for your trees, you ask us to share our ideas with you and
yes.
Your audience. And this is my idea, because the last time I talked to you, you labeled me a black nationalist.
I didn't label you anything. I said to you that I'm hesitant when people label themselves, because very often they don't understand the labels.
Well,
and
I didn't label
for example,
myself. You
what
labeled
you
me.
Your definition, for example, of what you just said, Pan-Africanism, they're very, very different interpretations of it. And I don't want to get into a discussion about your version of philosophy, your particular political philosophy, as opposed to somebody else's particular philosophy. As opposed to whatever the standard philosophy is, I don't get that. It's just
well,
not
I
moving. It doesn't move the discussion beyond what your personal thinking is. And if you noticed on the program, the idea is to bring to bear your personal thinking, if that's what it is, to contemporary issues and to help us understand that. In that context, but to just say, well, this is my personal philosophy and I want to take the time to tell you what it is and, you know, to explain an ideology to you, it's not the best use of time on the air.
Well, that wasn't the purpose of me calling today is because the last time that I called your program, you seemed to assume that I didn't know what. Well, first of all, you labeled me as a black nationalist. And,
I did not.
I
don't want to quarrel with you. I did not do that.
No, I don't want to quarrel with you because
I did not label you anything. I refrain from labeling people because I don't like it myself. I don't like labeling myself. I don't run around labeling people and their political ideologies. I only say that for the most part, the people I have met who swear up and down that they are this or they are that, actually are at variance with the philosophy without them knowing it. They imagine that they are such and such, but they really
are at variance. Well, then I guess
this
doesn't apply in my case
this is not a fruitful discussion we're having because in the end, what we're discussing is your personal belief, and that's great. It's your personal belief and your personal ideological tenets that you hold to. That's fine, but in and of itself, that's not a fruitful discussion for us. If you can interpret contemporary issues or interpret the issues and events that we're talking about through whatever prism you see the world, that's far more interesting and far more profitable use of time. But to tell us, what Pan-Africanism is and what nationalism is, it's really not. It's really not a very interesting conversation.
I would love to dialogue with you, but every time I call, it seems you misrepresent what I'm saying, and then you respond to your misrepresentation. But I was trying to say, Utrecht, that, when I called the last time, I was saying that I don't hear anyone speaking about how this Spanish-speaking immigration from south of the United States is affecting black people in America, and you began to speak about the contributions of African immigrants in the United States, and I'm well aware of that, and as a Pan-African, as a Pan African thinking person, the idea of an African being an immigrant doesn't even resonate in my mind. This is why, in reference to the Haitian children, I not only... Are you still there?
Yes, I'm listening.
Okay. I not only called the two African representatives in Congress in Maryland, but I also called the two state senators. Two senators from Maryland, also two of the representatives from Texas, and Charlie Rangel from New York, as well as Ms. Wilson in Florida. And I did get a response finally from Ms. Wilson, which wasn't much of a response. She said that the administration said that they would look into it. Yeah. But anyway, what I'm saying is that this immigration, the Spanish-speaking immigration, since they're mostly low-skilled people, not very well educated, and they're not coming here in the same way that other immigrants have traditionally come here, meaning that, that there's a guarantee that they have the means to take care of themselves and they wouldn't be a burden on the country. You know, all this is not being, it's not happening with these immigrants. And so anyway, I'm not hearing any discussion about how this is affecting Africans in America.
Okay. Number one, if I could make a comment on that. Number one, you should see this situation in broader perspective. It is not about the problem here is because you're seeing it so narrowly, you're losing sight of what the big picture here is. The big picture is, of course, to pit people against each other. So you'll have, well, the African Americans would be mad at the Latinos coming in because they're taking jobs. Well, statistically, that is not significant. That is not a significant problem. That's statistically because it just isn't the case. Number two, there's a difference between an immigrant and a refugee. And all immigrants, pretty much, the imperative for immigration is economic. What ought to concern you is what is happening that systemically puts African Americans at the bottom rung of the ladder. That is really what the issue is. And you're in Baltimore, you're a pan-Africanist, you have an African American mayor, you have Baltimore is a black town. What is the problem with gathering the strength of black Baltimore to see to black Baltimore's interests? Nothing. You know, that's the problem. The problem isn't about immigrants coming into Baltimore and taking the jobs of blacks. The problem is that blacks have allowed the city of Baltimore simply to, you know, be completely outside of their ability to control or influence anything important in. Black folks have nothing in terms of clout in Baltimore, and yet you have all these numbers. So the issue is not about getting angry at about people, Latinos coming into Baltimore. The issue is you've been there all this time. You've been electing rotten government all this time. You've been out of the mix all this time. You refuse to take control of your community all this time. So don't wake up now and invoke Pan-Africanism as the answer to why it is people need to stand up now and face down the Latinos who are taking their jobs. You've been doing the wrong thing for a long time in Baltimore, and you are seeing the natural byproduct of it. The insistence that leadership be accountable, the insistence that your vote have value, the insistence that you control your community and all aspects within it, if that is really what the situation is. In every community where you have a dominant group, they control all the apparatus of the day-to-day operation is in their hands. Baltimore, the housing is lousy. Education is lousy. Healthcare is lousy. Police protection, forget it. You know, you every aspect of life in Baltimore that the people of Baltimore have direct control over, they've refused to do it. So it is ridiculous to say now that the problem is people coming in and taking the jobs. That's the problem. So if you could fashion a Pan-Africanist response to that, not just theoretically, we're not talking theory here now, the application is what I'm interested in. The application of all this theory, if I see it evidenced in Baltimore, I would say, well, gee, let me take another look at this. But I'm seeing a lot of theory, but no real application of all that theory in any part of Baltimore. That is the issue. Black people have abrogated the responsibility, by and large, across the nation. They have just walked away from the responsibility to secure their interests.
Yes, ma'am. I get your point, Eutrice, and I agree with everything that you have just said. Now, it's not a matter of being angry. I don't think that I've expressed anger, and I certainly don't think that I'm sounding angry. And it's not a matter of just waking up. This is what you're saying is something that some of us have been working on in Baltimore, and I would imagine that there are Africans working all across the country to build an infrastructure whereby we are self-sufficient and we can exert our will. But as of yet, this hasn't happened, as you say, and I agree with you 100%. But one of the ways that you cause things to happen is that you have to have discussion about it. You have to talk about it. And what I'm saying again is that I'm hearing no one expressing how this immigration is affecting Africans in America.
Well, again, part of the question, that also is a question of leadership. And by the way, I just wanted to put this bug in your ear. A large number of the people that you think, you know, you are identifying as Latinos are actually black.
No, ma'am, I am
so,
not.
You just need to understand that.
Excuse me, Eutrice. You're assuming.
As a Pan-Africanist, you need to understand that when people talk about immigration, you're talking about Dominicans, you're talking about Hondurans, the Afro-Hondurans, Afro-Nicaraguans, the African blood strain runs all the way through Central and South America. So don't fall into that pattern of saying these people are Spanish speaking and we are different. No, you have to, it's time to develop an entirely different point of view based on what you say you are about, Pan-Africanist. You look at Marcus Garvey and you say, well, gee, now he didn't call himself a Pan-Africanist. He never even used the word, never used the term. He just united the black world. And whether you were Garifuna from Honduras, or whether you were Ethiopian, or whether you're from the South, it didn't matter to him. He understood need to bring everybody together. So, you know, basically what I'm saying to you, Green, is this.
Yes, ma'am.
I think it is imperative that you see. I'm not suggesting that you change your ideological viewpoint in any way. That's your decision. That's your choice. That's fine. But we have a tendency many times to occupy a theoretical world, and we don't see the direct application, and we still, even as we profess, you know, one particular ideology, we are also incorporating all of the contradictions of the standing order. And this is a conflict. If you're going to talk immigration, and if you want to talk about immigration from Latin America and what it's doing to Black people, that the very least I would expect that if you're going to have a conversation like that, you do some statistical analysis to find out if you even have a case. But you haven't done that. You want to do take a look at the patterns of immigration and see where people are settling.
And I can quite well speak for myself. On your show one time,
look how much time we've wasted, and we've gotten very little. But go ahead.
On your show, I called in one time to say we should be careful about labels, and particularly those labels Spanish, Latino, and Hispanic, because labels are political, and those three particular labels are used to separate Black folk who live in the Caribbean and other places who speak Spanish from other Africans. I also said on your show that people like the Dominicans, the Cubans, the Puerto Ricans are essentially Black people, and you told me they were Taino. Now,
that's correct. That's also correct.
Black people,
you know, again,
DNA,
you have to, if you understand and you study, you get to understand the world in a very different way. I'm not going to let's make a decision in our future conversations. Let's not discuss your personal point of view. It's of no relevance to me or to the discussion. Your personal beliefs, you know, I've been friends with people for 40 years. I've never asked them what's their personal point of view about anything. I'm interested in what their thoughts are. So let's throw that out. Whatever your personal point of view, it is not important to champion it and to promulgate it and to preach about it. Let's see how, through your personal point of view, you see the world. That's important, and that's fascinating, and that's interesting conversation. But to tell me about Pan-Africanism, and I could seriously take you to task on your interpretation of it, but to have that conversation is not useful. It is useful if you can tell me, as a person who subscribes to this ideology, who lives by a particular ideology, as such a person, how do you see the world? Do you understand the world? Can you break down certain things for us? And in a way that gets us all involved in participating in your conversation. But it isn't interesting to just listen to you. This is a theme that you stress all the time in your conversation, and it's tedious. So let's say today, for the next time you call, I want to hear your interpretation of the political reality at an entirely different level, because you are supposed to now be involved in the applied science of politics, your political understanding. So let's hear that in your next round of conversation. Can I get a commitment from you that that's going to happen the next time we talk? Is he there? Are you there, Green? Okay, apparently not. That's the next, what I'd like us to do. And that's what I like us to do on this program. I haven't asked anybody, and it's not important to me, what individually, what your personal thinking is. Tell me the issue and how you are breaking it down. And we can all appreciate that, and we can all participate in that. But when you come from this small part of the world, and you're comfortable there, and you want to drag us all there in the little closet with you, we can't go. We all can't fit. So let's see if we can have a whole different level of conversation the next time we engage. And I want to say, I respect you, and I hope that you call again and we can engage in conversation. But that brings us to the end of our program today. Very, very considered thoughts and opinions, and I want to thank you for offering your best. It is the reason that this program is meaningful, not just to me, but to everybody. I get good reviews, and I get good feedback, and I also get a barb or two from time to time. Reach me at leadstories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead, and keep it right here. Wake Up Call with Richard Martin is next. Thank you for the pleasure and privilege of your company.